Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have an episode about ADHD, or is it PTSD, why so many women are misdiagnosed between the two. And I do not know enough information about this, so I have brought on an amazing guest, Amanda Moses. I'm going to put in all of her information on the show notes if you'd like to follow her on Instagram. I love the way that she so passionately talks about the misinformation out there. I love that, and that's what really drew me to your Instagram account, Amanda.
Oh, thank you, Jane.
There are so many podcasts and information out there that is incorrect, and I find it quite grating. So I love it when you go through research and stuff that is not quite right, because I'm like so drawn in as soon as you post.
I think it's my role as an educator, because I work in the space of supervising and training other psychologists. Like, my platform really is about education. And though my audience tends to be mostly allied health professionals, I can see why it also draws in just general community members, because I think that we do see a lot of information online and it can be hard to understand sometimes, like, how much of this is true or factual, or how much of this is just based on opinion or, I don't know, some kind of media sensation at the moment.
Yeah, oh, I agree. And I think that's why I love a lot of your content. If you haven't checked out Amanda's Instagram, I'm going to put the links in the show notes. So, Amanda, for anybody who doesn't know you, do you want to give us a couple of bullet points about who you are?
So I'm a senior psychologist. I'm also a PhD candidate researching autism identification. And I'm also a proud ADHD mum of three little kids as well. So I've been working as a psychologist for a really long time now. And in my clinical practice, I focus specifically on assessing and diagnosing really highly masked and more complex presentations of autism and ADHD. But outside of that, predominantly my work really is in training and mentoring and supervising psychologists. So I think my passion area is really with neurodivergence and neuroaffirming practice, and really trying to make sure that our health professionals are getting appropriately educated on this so that we can better serve our community members.
Oh, absolutely. And if there's anybody out there who has been turned away by a practitioner and still feels that there's something that they would like to have their child assessed for, or themselves, myself and my children were only picked up by a very experienced autism and ADHD clinical psychologist on the Sunshine Coast, who would probably be quite a similar, I would say, education level and passion level to you. That's all she does. Is highly marked. Yeah. If there's anybody out there that has been turned away, I always encourage them to go to a clinical psychologist.
I agree, Jane. And look, I should just emphasize that being endorsed, say, as a clinical psych or an ed and dev psych or something as such, doesn't necessarily provide someone the qualifications to assess and diagnose autism and ADHD. Typically, psychologists will get that specialized training once they're already registered. That's not something we learn at university, which is crazy. Like, we probably do one subject, or one lecture, I should say, not even a subject, one lecture on autism throughout our degrees. Like, we don't learn enough about it. And so I think that what people don't realize is that, unfortunately, while there are many health professionals that are trained to do diagnostic assessments, not enough clinicians are actually trained to understand less stereotype presentations of autism and ADHD, those who tend to have, you know, high masking presentations, and certainly doing it also from an affirming point of view. So I agree with you that if you still feel like there's something going on here and you've been assessed, but it didn't feel like it quite captured you, I've actually myself had to reassess clients and looked at their old reports and thought, wow, like, there was so much missed here. And they did end up being autistic ADHD. So don't let that deter you if you feel still strongly about the fact that you could potentially be neurodivergent. You really need to find the right clinician.
Yeah, and I think you've made a great point, because I did some training with Esther Fadook. I don't know how you say her last name.
Oh, Esther Fadook. She's my colleague and friend as well.
Yeah. Oh, well, she's a registered psychologist. And
she is.
I loved her training. So you're right. When I say clinical psychologist, I really mean anybody with lived experience who's done that high-level training.
Yeah.
I think you've made a great point. I don't mean that, you know, registered psychologists can't do it, because
I know
some
that.
Are incredible.
Yeah. And look, I understand you didn't mean it from that perspective. I think that it's so helpful for the community to know that difference too, because you would see a title and assume, oh, political, they must know more, they must be better. But actually, you'd probably be really best served by trying to find a psychologist who really actually advertises themselves as someone who works with highly internalized, high mass presentations, they're neuroaffirming, and perhaps even they have lived experience as well. There are a lot of lived experience clinicians out there that I think do a really great job.
Oh, I completely agree. Okay, let's move on. I actually could do a whole podcast just on that subject, but I'm going to force myself to move on. ADHD and PTSD. Now, it's interesting what we just talked about, because one of the other reasons that I always encourage people in our Facebook group particularly to go and seek another assessment from a psychologist, one of the ones we just spoke about, is because of the amount of misdiagnosis that a lot of women have been through by the time they get to this path. And myself included, I was like, I've been diagnosed with so many things. I would actually just love to know what is real and what was not. So I went through a whole assessment just because I wanted to understand that better. So when we talk about ADHD and PTSD, where is the overlap, do you think?
I think that it's a tricky one, because I think that this question comes up a lot in a professional setting. So if the health professionals are confused, I can't imagine how much community members must be confused about it, right? And I think that some of this is in part to blame because of, like, you have people like, say, Gabe Amate and other people that have come out in more recent years trying to claim that ADHD is just a trauma response, when we in fact know that that would not be further from the truth. But unfortunately, those types of sentiments have filtered into professional settings. And now I've observed, as someone who trains and supervises psychologists, that people, as even psychologists, seem genuinely confused. They're like, I don't know how to distinguish between this. I don't know if I can even diagnose ADHD if trauma is present. And so I do a lot of work training in this space. And I think that some of the things that people tend to be confused about are things around attentional differences. Like, we know that an ADHDer will struggle with attentional regulation, and that may be true too of somebody who's experienced trauma. We know that that kind of brain fog that an ADHDer experiences may be confused potentially with dissociation, as we might see in somebody who's experienced trauma, as well as things like emotional regulation differences, impulsivity, hyperactivity. So there are these elements that seemingly overlap, but I think that there are really clear distinguishes between them and what is what.
So then it is very confusing, and I think you've made some great points. How then would someone of your level of experience kind of start to even tease them apart if you had somebody in front of you?
Yeah. So most of my work I do is with really complex clients, and I would say the far majority have experienced trauma and are now questioning neurodivergence as well. And so, yes, that is my role of trying to work out, okay, so we might have PTSD here as well as potentially ADHD and autism. How do I kind of capture this whole experience? And I think quite often what I like to remind clinicians is it doesn't necessarily need to be about exclusion, like, is it PTSD or ADHD, but rather, is it potentially both? And so what we do know from the research, for example, is that those who are autistic and ADHD are more likely and more susceptible to experiencing trauma, perhaps because of, first, their vulnerability to it, and secondly, because of the way they process traumatic events. And so we see a higher incidence of trauma in this population, meaning that I really like to re-emphasize to people that most of the time it's going to be both. It's not about saying we need to rule out trauma to understand if it's ADHD, because many ADHDers have trauma. So you need to understand, what does it look like when an ADHDer has trauma versus it's just somebody with trauma, right? And that they're not also an ADHDer. And so for me, I usually start with trying to predate traits and say, okay, so if the trauma started when they were 8, is there any evidence or is there any self-reports of traits that started prior to that time? Because that would indicate the likelihood of neurodivergence with trauma. But more often than not, it's never that easy. I often have clients who experience trauma in that developmental period, meaning that I can't predate it. And that's okay, because then what I'm looking for is how those traits manifest throughout their life. And so if we're kind of coming back to some of those things that some people get confused about, like let's start with attentional differences. And so what I expect to see with an ADHDer is this pattern of attention that is typically characterized by being very attentive to tasks or activities that they're subjectively interested in or they find rewarding, versus somebody with PTSD who won't necessarily have that discrepancy. Their attention isn't regulated based on reward and motivation and interest. But if there are attentional regulation differences, it's usually driven by fear, hypervigilance, anxiety. So it's about a sense of not feeling safe and having to stay on high alert for potential threats in the environment. And because they're on high alert for potential threats in the environment, they're not fully able to regulate their attention to what's happening in the moment. And so that looks really different. And of course, if they have both ADHD and trauma, I'll see a pattern of both. And I'll be able to distinguish between the times that their attention wasn't regulated because they were on high alert. But then there are times where it occurs without psychological distress and it's purely just about motivation and reward versus this activity's mundane and I just can't get myself to focus on it. And so they're not things that I should see with someone with PTSD. It should typically occur in the context of hypervigilance.
Well, Amanda, I think what we have seen in your response is the difference between a passionate psychologist, very highly educated, and, you know, that's obviously done a lot of professional development on autism, ADHD, PTSD, versus a lot of practitioners that are out there. For example, I have had a couple of women who write to me recently who have been to see psychiatrists who have all had the same response. Let's rule out the trauma. Let's sort that out first. And then they won't give the poor woman even to try any ADHD medication. And they keep holding it over them, it feels like. And every time they go to the appointment, they still don't get the medication that they just want to try. And this trauma, I mean, trauma can be, they might be in this rat race thing for 2 years and still never get access to even try some ADHD medication. So I think the way that you've answered that question just shows me the difference so clearly.
Yeah. And to me, it's so clear as well. And that's why I suppose I do a lot of work with educating and training, because I want that to be clear to other professionals too, because I have too heard that sentiment where I've had psychologists ask me and seem genuinely confused that, well, I heard that I wasn't allowed to diagnose ADHD if trauma might be there. I have to rule that out, or I have to treat that first and then see what happens. And I'm like, no, nowhere in our scientific literature does it say you need to do that. Our DSM, which is our diagnostic manual, doesn't even state that. Like, when we diagnose in our diagnostic manual, there are certain conditions which will say, you must exclude this before you can actually make this diagnosis. It doesn't say that for ADHD. And that's what really baffles me about, like, where did this rumor come from? And why are so many people believing this when it's not grounded in scientific evidence or even our diagnostic manual? It's very perplexing to me, because I think that if you're an ADHDer who's experienced trauma and the psychiatrist is trying to only focus on trauma, that they're going to miss a really big picture, because I think that ultimately neurodivergence and your neurotype, whether you're neurotypical or ADHD or autistic or whatever it is, like, it's the most fundamental part of the way that your brain works and the way you experience life. And if I'm disregarding that and trying to treat somebody or trying to provide therapy or help them manage, And I'm missing the biggest picture about who they are and how they process information and how they experience the world, I am most likely going to provide very ineffective treatments. And so I think that we need to understand somebody's neurotype as like the most fundamental aspect of them, because that then shapes how I provide the therapy and treatment I'm providing.
Yes. And, you know, this is one of the trickiest parts, I think. I feel like I'm a little frontline-y with it, like in terms of, you know, I have a lot of the women who are going to the appointments, they're sending me emails, DMs, it's all over the Facebook group. And it's tricky because I had already been diagnosed by a psychologist by the time I got to a psychiatrist. So I presented very textbook because I knew what they were looking for. And I was like, give me the answer. I want to try some medication. But when women are getting ready for an appointment, of course, they, one, want to be diagnosed properly, right? They want to feel like it. They definitely do. And they want to be confident in that assessment. But then I also say in the same breath, be really careful with trauma, because if you bring that up, you may, depending on the psychiatrist, go on a merry-go-round for 2 years where you're not getting access to the medication. And some of these women do not have thousands and thousands of dollars to try different appointments. So they've got so much in this one thing and they don't know whether to be honest and, you know, get that psychiatrist to see the full picture to get the right treatment, or if they should just be presenting this one thing because they just want to try some medication. It's so tricky.
It is really tricky, and it's personally just really upsetting for me because I see this a lot as well. And I just genuinely feel really upset for our community members that are experiencing this, because it's so expensive. Like, it's no joke how much it costs to go get an assessment, and access even just a standard psychiatry appointment is so expensive, as is a diagnostic assessment. And I'm not devaluing any of the work that us clinicians do, but I'm just aware that this is a service that costs a lot of money because a lot of work goes into it from our part. But it upsets me because I see that so many people are being let down by health professionals. Like, I mean, this idea that you have to rule out trauma to diagnose ADHD isn't really grounded in anything. And that's bothering to me, that somebody would need to pay thousands of dollars and then ultimately, you know, go around in circles for years, as you said, without actually getting appropriate care. And we do actually have a lot of research on that, though. I mean, we know how much harm is being caused because of misdiagnosis and people going missed for both autism and ADHD. I was just presenting on this recently in a workshop I did, but essentially, like, when I was looking at the research, you could clearly see that people who get diagnosed later with autism and ADHD tend to come with more complex mental health problems. So they'll have a lot more co-occurring mental health problems, higher rates of like suicidal ideation, suicidality, etc. And those who are diagnosed earlier in life, particularly with autism, I should point out, seem to have lower levels of associated like mental health comorbidities. And so in that, it actually becomes like a protective factor. Getting diagnosed earlier, getting identified earlier, becomes a protective factor for someone's mental health and well-being. But too often what we're seeing is people getting about 10 different labels before they finally get the correct one, which is often ADHD or autism. And they're just, it's just really disappointing. I think it upsets me to hear that and hear that it still occurs, because it just doesn't feel right.
Well, I think it's people like yourself and, you know, Mari Carmen and Esther Fedorkins, you know, the lady from the Neurodivergent
Women. Oh, Monique Mitchelson. Yes.
Monique Mitchelson. You know, there's so many psychologists out there that are doing that training. And that's so important, because that's how we'll see that change. So if we take a step back, so with women, for example, or just people, if they have ADHD, they're going to be more likely to experience trauma. Do you think this is part of the pathway of being misdiagnosed?
Partly, yes, I think so. But I think also there are some other factors for that. If we're talking about women and those that are assigned female at birth specifically, I actually presented on this last year at the big ADHD conference in Australia. But like basically the topic was like, why are women, females, AFAB, girls, et cetera, getting late diagnosed and missed? And a lot of it comes down to a few things before we even get to trauma, but it's that the criteria for ADHD, when it was written originally, the sample size or the population that they drew these traits from, I think it was, I don't want to misquote this, but I have it written down somewhere. It could have been like 70 to 90% young male boys, right? That could be wrong, but it was very significantly based on young boys' presentations. And so what's happened is that a lot of then the screening tools and measures and things like that that are out there trying to identify ADHD are also based heavily off, you know, young boy samples. And it wasn't until, I think it was the DSM-4, like it wasn't until really the last 20 or so years that they even realized that ADHD could go into adulthood. Everyone thought, like the assumption was that ADHD is a problem in youth, and by the time that person's an adult, they grow out of it. So in the DSM, it was a childhood categorized disorder. You couldn't diagnose it in adulthood, I think really until like the last 20 odd years or something. But what we've also seen in the research is a few things, which is that firstly, when we're thinking of the people that tend to pick it up first, like GPs, parents, teachers, there seems to be a bias towards males. So in that, even when a young girl seems to have the same level of, I'm just saying symptom, but I know that this is not affirming, I'm just using medical terminology here. I don't believe it's symptom, but let's say symptoms of ADHD, even when they're experiencing and expressing the same levels, they're still less likely for the teacher or the parent or the GP to say, oh, I think that could be ADHD, even with the same symptom level. But let's say they pass that and someone does manage to pick them up. Even if they get to the health professional, they're less likely to get a diagnosis, even with the same symptom severity level. Even if they make it through that and get a diagnosis, they're less likely to be offered medication. So there is bias and discrimination at every single step of the referral pathway for young girls and those assigned female at birth, every single level. So some of this is also about bias, discrimination, outdated ideas of this is only a problem that occurs in children and predominantly boys. This isn't something that affects girls. Also, females and those assigned female at birth might have slightly different presentations in that their hyperactivity tends to present more as verbal hyperactivity, verbal impulsivity, as opposed to, and mental restlessness, as opposed to the typical thing that we think of bouncing around the room, I can't sit still. And not saying some girls don't experience that too, but we do tend to see that they have more internalized traits or they don't quite always meet that stereotype. And so that in itself could also form another reason too.
Oh, absolutely. I think you've said that really well. If you happen to find the research article, send it through and I can put it into the show notes.
I made a document about it, so I'll send it to you.
Yeah. Just some people like to read, or is that Definitely. Just me? If we talk about RSD, which is rejection sensitivity dysphoria, most of the audience is going to know what that is because we've been there around that for a while now. But then on the other hand, people with PTSD have got sometimes those really deep emotional wounds. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, when you're looking at somebody, how would you possibly be able to see what the differences are between those?
Yeah. So I think the answer will lie in what the trigger is. So I think with PTSD, it's not necessarily going to be always rejection or criticism specific. I think their emotional wounds are going to be linked to their trauma narrative, which could potentially be abuse. It could be a whole range of things, right? But it would probably make sense in context of what they experience. So for example, let's say if they did experience neglect in their earlier years, that may leave them with a diminished sense of self-worth. And I think we do see a lot of that with trauma survivors, like low self-esteem, low sense of self-worth, things as such, which can be true too of ADHDers. For an ADHDer, this idea of RSD, rejection, sensitivity, dysphoria, it's still relatively new, this kind of phenomena. And it doesn't have a lot of research really testing this concept yet. And so what I'm going to say now isn't based on scientific research. It's based only on my clinical observations, because I think it's important to distinguish that. But I think that what I've noticed as I've been trying to process, you know, what is RSD and how does this fit into the ADHD framework? Because I think it's gained traction for a reason. I think there's a reason that so many people with ADHD resonate with it. It must mean something. And so I've been really trying to process and understand it and try and work out logically, like, how does this fit in with what I know of ADHD? If it does link to ADHD, how? How is that possible? What is it about having ADHD that would make you more sensitive to rejection or have these big emotional responses? And so I hypothesize two different things. I think that firstly, it's potentially because of the lived experience of ADHDers being that they are often internalizing this idea that they're lazy, they're not working hard enough, they're aloof, they're unorganized. And this stems all the way back to childhood, right? And I do think that ADHDers potentially receive more criticism, particularly in educational settings. And I think that this would set anybody up to be more sensitive to perceived criticism and rejection if that is based on your lived experience. I mean, I know that is true of other schemas in psychology, like they come about based on your real world experiences and what's happened to you. And so it makes sense to me that, yep, okay, that is likely true of an ADHDer that might make them then more hypervigilant or sensitive to rejection and criticism, etc. But then also when I think about our emotional regulation differences, so with ADHD, it really primarily is a difference in executive functioning. I know a lot of people talk about it as this attentional deficit. It's not. Really, ADHD is primarily characterized by executive functioning differences. And one of our executive functioning systems that is impacted by ADHD is one called inhibitory control. And our inhibitory control system basically regulates our impulses as well as our emotions. And so I think that when we see emotional dysregulation in ADHD, big emotional reactions, irritability, temper tantrums in childhood or anger outbursts, that it's really about that executive functioning system. That if I struggle with an inhibitory control, it means that I'm going to struggle with managing impulses, managing emotional impulses, managing big emotions in the moment and being able to regulate them, and most likely having some really disproportionate reactions at times to situations because of that executive functioning system. And so I think for me, RSD tends to make better sense when I look at it in the framework of that executive functioning system, which I know is true of ADHDers, because perhaps what people are experiencing, this idea that they have this big emotional response, is about difficulty regulating. So they're already perhaps more susceptible to that maybe heightened alert for criticism and rejection because of lived experience, but then because they also have differences in how they are able to manage impulses and emotional regulation, the response seems really big at the time and hard to manage and hard to regulate and control.
Oh, okay. You are so interesting, Amanda. I've like, I'd love to talk to you for like hours. Anyway, I was like, oh my God, I've got so many questions, but we will continue on. Okay. So let's say somebody is diagnosed with PTSD, but actually they have ADHD, or the ADHD isn't picked up and it's actually both. How does this impact treatment and why is it such a problem?
I think the problem is that when trauma is present and when we fail to account for ADHD, being in the picture is that you're probably going to have a traumatized person with significantly worse executive functioning than someone without it. Because as an ADHDer, our executive functioning is pretty challenging on a regular day. But when you add in layers of stress or mental health problems or any other psychological issue, it gets worse. And so if I'm not capturing that and I'm assuming someone just has trauma and I'm trying to treat that, I'm missing a really big part of the picture. I'm also unlikely to be able to assist them fully. Like, I'm not saying that trauma treatments will be like they could cause harm, because if there's trauma there, great, we should be treating the trauma too. But if I'm failing to account for the fact that this person is also ADHD and the impact that executive dysfunction is having on their daily life, I'm missing a really big piece here. And I think that what we will just see is often ineffective treatments that don't miss the mark, or this sense from clients where it's like, I don't feel like I'm progressing or getting anywhere. I feel really stuck. And I don't feel like this is helping me, because there's this huge piece of the puzzle that is completely being missed here and not managed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. That's one perspective if the ADHD is missed and not accounted for. But on the other way, if somebody with PTSD is misdiagnosed with ADHD and then they are given stimulant medication, then how would that impact the person with PTSD that doesn't even have ADHD?
Yeah, I think that the first thing I want to say to that is just to be really clear that I think the media and certain online platforms might have done a really good job at convincing the public that this happens a lot and we need to be really worried. But when you look at the research, it's actually just not supportive of it. What we do see is you're more likely to be misdiagnosed as, say, having trauma or borderline personality disorder or a whole range of other things, when ADHD is probably the best explanation. We don't actually have a lot of literature supporting that, oh, somebody's been misdiagnosed with ADHD, but it was actually trauma. So I just want to make sure everyone comfortably knows that what we're seeing in the media is very sensationalist, isn't really grounded in any of the science, right? And let's just say hypothetically, somebody is. I can't say for sure what the implications would be of taking stimulant medication if you don't actually have ADHD. But I do understand that stimulant medication often is given in really short acting forms. So typically, say if you're taking something like Ritalin, it lasts in your system for 3 hours before it gets, whatever the word is, it gets passed out. You might have longer acting ones like, say, Vyvanse, that stay in your system for 12 hours and then they get passed out. And so what could the risk be? Perhaps whatever the effect is in those few hours, I think it's really hard to say, but I think my concern would be more about missing ADHD than potentially misdiagnosing it, because of how quickly and rapidly you can come off that medication without it lingering in your system.
Oh, I completely
agree. And we know
they're
safe, right? I just want to say that too. We know they're safe. They're safe for kids. They're safe for adults. It's your choice whether you medicate, of course, but they're fairly safe and regulated medications too.
Oh, I agree. And I think this is why we came back to the point before that, why would you not let someone try a stimulant medication if it's short acting and see if it works rather than holding it back? I haven't heard anybody actually say that they had ADHD stimulant medication and it didn't work. They didn't even have it. I mean, you're right. The media says that it happens. I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it either. And I haven't really read any research on it either. And I'm pretty deep in the research. So I think that a lot of it is very sensationalist and it's almost just fear-mongering. And I don't like it, because I think it takes away from the validity of all those who really do have ADHD and really do need this medication. And it creates this space of like mistrust, where we're having people like those that you mentioned go and seek out professional help, and there's skepticism about, well, is it really ADHD? Maybe it's just this. And this sense of distrust to the community about whether or not they actually have ADHD, or if they're just trying to get these drugs, which, again, I think that it's really causing more harm than it is doing any good for ADHDers.
I agree. And I think holding the medication back from so many people, which is what I personally see, creates more of an underground dangerous market than what it would do if they just prescribed what they saw instead of holding it back. Because then you get this mum underground thing that only happens because of desperation.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's say, Amanda, if a woman does have ADHD and PTSD, what would an effective treatment plan look like?
I think that an effective treatment plan would be looking at both things together. So I don't think we need to manage one before managing the other, because again, I feel like ADHD is such a fundamental aspect of how someone experiences every moment of their day that you can't ignore that. So let's say if that person chose to be medicated, they would take medication for ADHD or maybe try other management strategies, whatever their approach is, while also recognizing and addressing any relevant trauma. Usually things like EMDR, fairly evidence-based for trauma. But I think it's also really important for the therapist who's working with their client to understand that this ADHDer has trauma, as opposed to we're just looking at trauma. Because again, you know, we're thinking of all those executive functioning differences, even how they engage in therapy and how they process information is going to look different. And we want to be able to accommodate and support that person to make sure we're setting them up for success and make sure that we're really accommodating their neurotype and their unique way of learning and processing and experiencing and taking that into account while we're managing trauma.
I think you've said that really well, actually. You've got a great way of being able to take all the complex and make it sound quite simple when it's not simple at all. Okay, so last big question, and then we're going to move on to the kind of takeaways. I hear a lot, and I think people hear a lot, the trauma-informed kind of buzzword that keeps being thrown around. But I also wonder how many people actually understand what that means. Like, what does that mean for someone with ADHD, and how do we find a professional that is trauma-informed? What are the differences?
Yeah, I think trauma-informed care is about trying to create environments and provide support that really actively recognizes and respects the impact that trauma has on somebody without causing any further harm or distress. For ADHD women specifically, trauma-informed care might mean working with professionals who understand that the experience of living with ADHD, especially when it has gone undiagnosed or late diagnosed, often comes with these layers of trauma, including experiences of like chronic invalidation, stigma, and struggles with self-worth. And trauma-informed care is meant to be gentle. It's meant to be validating. It's meant to be respectful and really collaborative, really centering that person's experience. And I think for me, that's about treating our client like an equal expert. So when I approach my clinical work, I don't approach it as in, I'm here as the expert and you're there and I'm just, I don't know, shaping this and kind of informing how or dictating how this is going. I really like to treat my clients like equal experts. They are the expert of them and their life experience. And I'm just bringing my expertise on psychology and neurodivergence. And together we're collaborating and trying to understand what's going on for them and how best to help them. And so I think that finding professionals who understand both trauma and ADHD probably involves looking for those who explicitly describe their practice as trauma-informed, as neurodiversity-affirming. And I think professionals with that dual understanding are usually pretty transparent about their expertise on their website. But I think good starting points are referrals or recommendations from like trusted members of the ADHD community or support groups. And I also urge you all that if you're meeting a new professional, don't be afraid to ask direct questions. Don't be afraid to ask them, can you tell me about your experience with trauma-informed approaches, or can you tell me about how you approach ADHD through a trauma-informed or neurodiversity-affirming lens? Tell me a bit more about your experience with this, because I think professionals who comfortably address these questions without being defensive will typically demonstrate like a genuine understanding and commitment to supporting ADHD is effectively? And I know that if I were asked this question, and I have from time to time, I would very happily answer new clients. And I respect that they're asking that because they're trying to find the most appropriate person for them. You're about to invest potentially a lot of money. You should be able to ask these questions and get a really respectful, well-informed answer.
Oh, I love the way you've said that. And I think what your answer then needs, or not needs or should, I suppose that's my opinion, but I think it'd be great to take that perspective and also apply it to pediatricians for our children around what you were saying, that the person is the expert on their life and you're the expert on being a psychologist. As a parent, I'm an expert on my child and they're the expert in being a pediatrician. So it's actually a 50-50. You don't need to be subservient to a pediatrician or a practitioner because 100%. We know a lot about our kids. So I love the way that you said that. That's so important because if that practitioner is kind of like, you know, you listen, I know best, that may not be the right person for you.
I agree. I think that we should be collaborative with our clients and respect their expertise on their life. Like even as a mum, like who knows your child better than you? And as yourself, who knows yourself better than you, right? Like you are the expert of you. But in saying that, it is okay as well to take advice and meet our health professionals halfway. They obviously have knowledge and skills and that's why they're in the job they're in. But don't lose yourself in the process. It's okay to trust yourself too and advocate for yourself. And I think a good clinician will just try and meet you halfway and bring their expertise, but also expect you to bring yours too.
Oh, I love that. Okay, we are finishing up, Amanda, which is sad for me, but we will do that. So in terms of having a key takeaway, and this is always hard when you have to like do a key takeaway message because there's always so much to say, but what would be an important message that you'd love ADHD mums to know about ADHD and PTSD?
I think for me, the most important message is that it's often not about, is it ADHD or PTSD, but rather ADHD and PTSD. And I think for many women, particularly mothers, the experience of living with undiagnosed or misunderstood ADHD can in itself be very traumatic. And ADHD brings daily stresses that accumulate over time. It creates an environment where I think trauma symptoms can actually flourish. And equally, trauma can amplify the severity and complexity of those executive functioning systems. So I think just recognizing that both can coexist will allow us to adopt a gentler, more holistic approach to ourselves, to support and healing, and just really understanding that interplay to help you advocate more effectively for yourself and for your children too.
Oh, perfect. Okay. I think there'll be a lot of people that will want to follow you on Instagram or have a look at some more of your work. Where would be the best place that people can find you or any resources? I'll put them in the show notes, but if you list them off, I'll know what to put in the show notes.
You can find me at amandamosespsychology.com.au. I have a lot of psychoeducational resources there that I developed for community members as well as allied health professionals. I also have a lot of free content there too, as well as my Instagram, which is at Amanda Moses Psychology. I share a lot of education and just knowledge, etc. And so very happy for you to connect with me there.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time, Amanda. That has been really, really interesting. And this is one of the big topics that I haven't been able to get anybody to come on and talk about yet. So this is going to be really well received. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.